Okay, welcome everyone. I'm Rob Olson, Dallas Lobster Swarm, and glad to see a good turnout on a day that a lot of people might be out Christmas shopping. Well, this is going to be much more interesting than Christmas shopping, I guarantee. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, but we are not going to meet at the end of December. But we're going to start up the second Tuesday in January. And while we're on this topic, I wanted to mention that Paul Kowalski, MD, Paul, raise your hand, raise both hands. He'll be speaking on the miraculous nature of human nature. He has written a book on this, and I promise you it's going to be an excellent talk. And he's a very philosophical man, and I think you're going to enjoy that. So put that on your calendar, Tuesday, January 8th. If you haven't paid already, if you can do so immediately after the lecture, Jack, you can raise Jack's our esteemed treasurer. It's $5 admission or $2 student admission. If you pay for 6 months in advance, it's only $35. Also, we want to remind you to pay for your meals. And every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay, and then we're stuck with that. So make sure that you pay your bills and tip your wait staff generously. We would really appreciate that. We have a website that has a lot of the same information. It's www.philosophersquorum.org. So take a look at that. We're going to try and get our spring schedule out there pretty quickly. Right, Ken?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
We've got quite a few great speakers lined up for you. We can also, if you're interested, you can go to Meetup. You can type in Dallas Lobster Swarm, and you can get set up for Meetup there. Has anybody heard of us through Meetup? Okay, so there's several of you. Great. I also want to introduce our newest board member, the esteemed David Alkeck. He's got the tie, and he's got the vest, and all that. He's looking great. He is the newest member. It's already helped line up some speakers, and so we want to welcome him. And we also want to welcome, and Patrick, I hope I don't embarrass you, Patrick Byers. He is a high school senior at Forney High School, and he's interested in philosophy. And so I thought, well, who better than David Drum to teach him all about philosophy and the free will versus determinism argument. So that's what David's going to be talking about some tonight. So he'll... David Drum will speak for 45 minutes or so, and they'll open up to questions. And so I'll be walking around with the mic, and people that come to this meeting like to talk, and so, you know, we don't need any Shakespearean soliloquies, just kind of, you know, a few statements and then ask a question. That would be very helpful. Okay? And then one last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. David Drum is a partner with Carrington Coleman here in Dallas. He is a transactional attorney focusing on real estate and oil and gas transactions. He's the former president of the Dallas Philosopher's Forum and currently serves as our vice president and has been our treasurer. He does a lot of teaching at his church, and he is just a very talented speaker. And his topic today is, and I'm going to try to show some emotion here. Wait, there's a baby in that bathwater! A naturalist defense of free will and agency. So now please join me in welcoming David Drum.
Thank you, Rob. I think it'll probably be obvious by the time we're done what stands in for the baby and what stands in for the bathwater, but if not, I'll come back and give a summary. This topic of free will versus determinism is, of course, kind of one of those tired old philosophical topics, and so I'm not going to try to do it soup to nuts, but I thought what would be instructive to focus on are some of the newer writings in this area, and there are quite a few of them, and what they do is bring in some of the information theory developments, some of the complexity chaos theory developments, some of the neo-Darwinian evolutionary theories, and that kind of application into this question, which I think, you know, provides some interesting insight, you know, from sort of some new theories into this topic. And in particular, I'm going to be touching on four books and the ideas in them. Of course, I can't cover them all, but at least touching on ideas in four books that have all come out in the last 7 or 8 years. Probably the one I'm going to be relying on the most has come out just in the last 12 months, and I think it's been a long time in the making, but its author is Terence Deacon, who is a neuroscientist and chairman of the anthropology department at California Berkeley. His book is called Incomplete Nature, How Mind Emerged from Matter. And then I'm also going to be drawing on Stuart Kaufman, who is at the University of Calgary, a biologist, and is a fellow at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who have done a lot of study in the complexity and chaos theories developments recently. His book is called Reinventing the Sacred. And then physicist David Deutsch, who's at Oxford, he's got several books, but one of his more recent ones called The Beginning of Infinity, Explanation that Transformed the World. And then for a little bit different tack, our friend Daniel Dennett, who is the only philosopher in this bunch. He's a philosopher at Tufts University in Massachusetts. He's also got several books, which you may be familiar with. Darwin's Dangerous Ideas, a great book on evolutionary theory. This one's focused on this particular issue called Freedom Evolves. And I was thinking, getting ready for this, how great it would be if we could have a panel with all four of these on a panel. But I don't quite have the budget to pull that off, so I'll have to just do the best to try to stand in for them on some of their ideas. The interesting contrast here is that the philosopher in the bunch is the one who is defending the doctrine of determinism. We'll talk about what that means a little bit later. All three of the scientists, a physicist and a neurophysicist, are not defending determinism. So we would normally think of determinism as being, you know, sort of the hard science side of things, but it's kind of interesting the way that breaks out. In framing the question, I thought it might be easier to talk in terms of sort of the Dennett's arguments and what he maintains, and because in trying to define free will and agency, there's been a lot of slipperiness here in the way these different authors treat that, whereas the contrary definitions seem to be pretty precise and succinct. So I'm gonna focus on some of the contrary definitions. Basically, it is Daniel Dennett's position in Freedom Evolves that what we think of as free will, in the ordinary naive sense of the word, is compatible with his definition of determinism. And Dennett's definition of determinism is quite simple. Determinism is the thesis that there is at any instant exactly one physically possible future. So the way he defines it, what that rules out is our common sense nature of branching future possibilities. You know, normally we would think just in everyday life that there's more than one future possibility available to us. That there is a future possibility in which, in driving home tonight, I obey the speed limit and stop at traffic signals, and then there's a possible future in which I don't do that. I drive recklessly back, and one of those will be realized, but both of them are possible. He maintains that only one of those futures is physically possible, and attempts to do it in a way that he says preserves a distinction between determinism and inevitability, which he says are not the same things, preserves our sense of that there's something morally culpable about bad action. You know, if you think about the basis of morality, if you're going to hold somebody accountable for a bad action, that would tend to imply that they could have done otherwise. You know, otherwise, why are you holding them accountable? I do not personally find his proofs convincing in the way he presents the material, and I actually find it kind of odd that after defining determinism the way he does, and then writing for 300 or some pages, that the last sentence in his book, or next to last sentence, is that we can understand how our freedom is greater than that of other creatures and see how this heightened capacity carries moral implications, noblesse oblige, we are in the best position to decide what to do next because we have the broadest knowledge and hence the best perspective on the future. So he says, we have the best position to decide what to do next. And he's just said there's only one physically possible future. How does he reconcile that? I think as I understand his main attack, he would say we can't act in a way that changes the future, but we can change our nature, and then our nature determines how we act, which seems to me like a little bit of an end run, because if you can change your nature, and then your nature changes how you act, then that seems to me saying you can change how you act. You're just backing it up one more step. But this is kind of where the baby in the bathwater comes in. I think what Dennett is trying to protect with his idea of determinism is to avoid an inroad of supernaturalism at any point in his explanation. And he feels like he can only avoid an intrusion of supernaturalism by defending this deterministic doctrine in what seems to be some pretty sophistic ways to my reading, some sort of tortured reasoning from the way I read it. And so I do call this talk a naturalistic defense of free will and agency. So what all of these four books have in common is they all do deal from the naturalistic framework. And so I want to spend a little bit of time, sort of outlining how, what naturalism would mean in this context. The obvious contrast to naturalism would be supernaturalism. And if you look at the history of human development in this regard and kind of condensing a whole lot into a few simple stages, it would seem to be that at a very early stage, humans really didn't have a distinction between a natural and a supernatural order. And this would be the belief that anthropologists call animism, where every force of nature would seem to be animated, with what essentially a quality that we would call mind, and our interaction with other forces, was the same as our interaction with other sentient beings. But as a little bit more mature understanding arose, this evolved into a polytheistic understanding where the forces of nature were felt to be separate from some kind of human-like agency, but nevertheless, there was some human-like agency. Say the volcano god would be in charge of the eruption of the volcano, the sun god would be in charge of the circling of the sun, and so forth. And so there's kind of a separation then of a supernatural sphere and a natural, but still the supernatural is in control. With the rise of the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers and Greek philosophy in general, there was an attempt made to try to supplant all of these supernatural explanations with some sort of natural, logical, rational, unified concept of causes, starting with Thales' assertion that everything was water, which sounds kind of primitive, but it's a place to start with, everything is one instead of there's all these different myriad personalities to deal with. Greek philosophy's probably most mature thinking on causal effects was Aristotle, who said basically, everything is explainable by four species of causes, two of which are internal. That would be the material and the formal cause. In other words, if you're looking at a clay pot, the material cause would be the clay in the pot. The formal cause would be the mold that causes it to have the shape that it has. And then there would be two external causes. There would be a final cause, which would be the end to which the pot was created, i.e. to hold liquid, its purpose. And then there would be an efficient cause. That would be what caused it to have that shape. That would be the potter and the wheel shaping the pot. And that seemed to provide, for 1,000, 1,500 years, pretty much the answer that was accepted in Western civilization as to causal effects, except that in the Thomistic compromise of St. Thomas Aquinas, who synthesized Christian theology with Aristotelian metaphysics, there was provision made for supervenience of supernatural intervention, for revelation, for miracles, and those kind of things. But these were, you know, temporary suspensions on a very fairly limited basis into this natural order. And I think what Dennett and people like Dennett are really trying to push back against is this heritage that there can be any kind of supervenient, kind of outside, Daniel Dennett uses the term skyhook in an evolutionary context, that there can be some kind of outside force reaching down. You know, you hear the phrase deus ex machina, ghost in the machine. You know, there can be some kind of outside force pushing in. With the change from medievalism to modern philosophy, Descartes, we normally mark as the watershed of that. And Descartes came up with a theory of dualism, which observed that there was this thinking substance that he could not deny, but there was also this material world that he knew only through his senses, and he could only postulate that those were separate realms governed by separate laws. He supposed that maybe there was the pineal gland at the crown of the scalp that would somehow connect these two, but he wasn't really certain about that. And we really were left with this heritage of Cartesian dualism as a result of that, where we started to think about the natural world as this interlocking order that was apart and separate from our subjective feelings, our understandings, our purposes, our motives. You know, these were believed to be on the other side of the Cartesian divide. And after Descartes, Newton developed his theories of mechanical dynamics, classical physics. And in the Newtonian paradigm, you've got this classical picture of matter in motion as billiard balls on a table colliding with each other, influencing each other's path. But in the classical dynamic theory, you can predict, it is the case that determinism is the result in the classical dynamic world, because if you know the position and the velocity of one billiard ball, then you can predict exactly the path of the ball that it's going to intersect with and where it will go, and there's not branching paths. It's just going to be simple interlocking cause and effect. And so I think this is really where we get our notion of determinism from, is this Newtonian idea of classical mechanics, classical dynamics, and I use the word dynamics to emphasize sort of the change aspect, the process aspect of it, as opposed to a substance kind of conception, because that's going to be important as we go along. The Newtonian world, you know, still existed on this one side of the Cartesian divide, and defined the material side of that divide, and left room for the immaterial, the mental side, to kind of have its own rules for a while. But then in the 19th century, there were a series of developments that happened that brought a lot new to the equation. When the physicists turned from simple mechanics to heat transfer and chemistry and things like that, they used concepts such as phlogiston was originally a concept for what caused a fire to happen, a substance that caused a fire to happen. Caloric, from which we get our word calorie, was also used as a stand-in for something that caused heat. And because of the heritage of Newtonian mechanics, there was this felt need to find something substantial, something, you know, material that explained all of these processes of heat transfer and combustion and processes like that. But further study drove the theory away from those kind of substantial explanations to more of a process, dynamic explanation of that. So you already have, really, in the first part of the 19th century, a little bit of a movement away from this, you know, strict materialist, atomistic character, and you're starting to talk in terms of processes. In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and introduced this concept of variation in biological species by natural selection. And this seriously caused question to be made about this Cartesian divide, because in the next book, about human origins, Darwin, you know, proposed that humans were evolved from apes. And so if humans were part of this evolution of natural selection, then the human mind must be on the natural side of the Cartesian divide and not on the what was thought to be the mental side. And so did that in fact collapse the mental side of the Cartesian divide into meaninglessness, and so now we had a combination of Newtonian mechanics and Darwinian biology that would really put everything into this kind of materialistic, kind of blind, purposeless progression. And that's no doubt why there was such a backlash against Darwin by a lot of the religious conservatives, because, you know, they kind of rightly felt their worldview was under attack, and hadn't quite figured out yet how to redefine it in the face of that. But only 7 years after Darwin's book in 1866, a guy named Clausius came up with major parts of the theory of thermodynamics. You're probably familiar with the first law of thermodynamics, that energy is neither created or destroyed, always preserved. Second law of thermodynamics is that energy tends to dissipate in a process called entropy. And so the unequal distributions of energy tend to cancel out by a process of dissipation, with the result that the work that can be done from unequal distributions of energy tends to wind down. Now this is a lot different juxtaposition from the Newtonian view, because in the Newtonian view, all of the equations are time reversible, meaning that the Newtonian equation about the interaction of a billiard ball runs in reverse exactly the same as it runs forward, and there's no reason in the Newtonian system to think that one direction of a billiard ball hitting a billiard ball is more natural than the other direction, the reversal of that process. But thermodynamics looks at, again, coming back to these systems, these dynamical systems, you're now no longer looking at atoms in collision. You're looking at a system of millions of atoms. Think of gas molecules in a tube. And there now is a very time directional concept, which is that over time that energy will tend to dissipate and become less able to do work, and the reverse is not equally likely. And it's a simple illustration of this. If you were to drop an egg onto the floor and watch it break, that would be a process of creating greater entropy. If you were to imagine those eggshells picking themselves up, coming back up, that would be a reversal of the process of entropy. If you ran that movie backwards, you would see something very unnatural about that. So already in the realm of thermodynamics, we're in a completely different level of phenomena than we are in the Newtonian atomistic world, because we now have this time arrow. And what would be considered natural, I want to draw that out because that's an important concept in the work of Deacon here, is this concept that there is, in all dynamical systems, there's one direction of change that is with the flow, spontaneous, natural. He uses the technical term orthograde. And then there's another direction that is more unnatural, against the flow, retrograde. And if you want to think of them simply, think of one as falling. You know, you just fall into it. It's just, you know, kind of the default setting. The other is more like swimming upstream, you know, what you have to do. And the concept of work really is, it's one of those concepts that is defined probably best in exactly that manner, which is work is what is necessary to produce that contrograde movement, that upstream movement, because you don't really have to work for the natural movement to happen. It just happens. And that evolved through these different levels of thinking. I didn't pick that up as I went through the progression, but if you go back to Aristotle, Aristotle thought that the natural orthograde spontaneous condition was a condition of at rest, and that it took what he called the unmoved mover, basically to take that position of rest and cause a motion by a final cause. What Newton's laws postulated is that the natural condition, the spontaneous condition, was not at rest, but movement, linear movement, at a constant rate. And so, you know, from Newton's theory, we know an object in motion tends to remain at motion, an object at rest tends to remain at rest. And so it's the inertial frame that is the what you fall into. And if you want to exert work and move in an orthograde manner, then you exert force to basically, force can be in the form of friction, which slows it down. It can be in the form of, you know, pushing back a barrier, but you exert some force to stop that movement. But when you move up then to the thermodynamic level that we were to, you have an entire reversal of that, because the falling orthograde motion in a thermodynamic system is toward maximum entropy. And the energy of the individual molecules, of individual atoms, can be the same, but the entropy is down if they're distributed equally. And so even though the total energy of the system is the same, you have less capacity for work. And so now you've got a different natural, a different spontaneous, but in both systems, you can, by interacting two of these systems, you can move one of them out of its spontaneous range into its non-spontaneous range. You do that with an object moving in straight linear motion by putting a barrier up, putting some friction up, intersecting with another option. In a thermodynamic system, if you have a box of gas molecules that is cooled to a certain temperature, in thermal equilibrium, and you put a heat source at one point, then you will create a differential between the molecules that are excited by that heat and the molecules here, and you'll once again create the capacity to do work by introducing something out of this system. We can carry that to one more level. It was in the early 20th century that the quantum mechanical system was discovered, which has to do with subatomic particles mostly, below the level of Newton's mechanical system. And in a quantum mechanical system, the natural, spontaneous, orthograde movement is a probability wave that doesn't cohere to a definite position or location unless there's some interaction with another quantum wave phenomena that requires the two waves to come to some consensus, you know, kind of like Boehner and Obama trying to agree on the budget. You know, they have to come to some consensus about where to locate. And so the non-spontaneous retrograde action in the quantum system is to go from a probability wave to a definite location. So you can see the progression here. We've got quantum systems in which it's natural for things to be indeterminate and unlocalized, but the ability by interaction between two quantum wave systems to fix it in a location. And then you get Newton's billiard balls on the table. It's natural for them to move in a straight line at a constant velocity unless you have another Newtonian particle which comes into collision and forces and does work to forces it to get out of that natural location. Then you have thermodynamic collections of Newtonian particles. They tend toward entropy unless you have another thermodynamic system that again does the work to pull this away from entropy. Where does Deakin take this? Well, he uses this kind of progression of levels to take it up a couple of more levels to get to living systems. Because, and the details of this are, I might be able to repeat them, but we'd probably be here longer than we want to repeat because there's a lot of details and intricacies to this argument. But in essence, Deakin's notion is that just as the thermodynamic level is above and supervenes on the classical dynamical level, and just as the classical dynamical level supervenes on the quantum dynamical level, that there is a morphodynamical level that supervenes on the thermodynamical. And an example of that would be a whirlpool in a stream, a convection current in a heated liquid. A snow crystal is an example, and actually some of the cellular automata that people have created in artificial computer programs are some examples. But these are examples of thermodynamic systems where, because of some boundary condition, in the case of a whirlpool, it's a boulder in the stream, but some boundary condition causes a local disturbance that tends to preserve its form of order, notwithstanding the circulation of particles through that. The whirlpool maintains its form, even though the water molecules are flowing through it and different all the time. And that is contrograde, again, in the sense of doing work against what is natural to a thermodynamic system, because the thermodynamic system would tend to want to smooth all that out. But because the boulder is there, the boulder is pushing against that thermodynamic system, causing this, in this case, order of the whirlpool to emerge. And then in an even more kind of complex, but I think nevertheless coherent explanation, Deakin postulates that if you take two morphodynamic systems, one of them being an autocatalytic system, meaning a system of chemical reactions where the reaction produces its own catalyst. In other words, the feedstock that transformation needs to take place, then you can create these pockets of order in a thermodynamic system also. But the autocatalytic system tends to run away from itself and eventually outstrip its ability to get the feedstock it needs. But if you combine that with another morphodynamic system, which is a containment system, kind of like the boulder a little bit in the whirlpool, then you have a way where maybe you can keep the rate of the autocatalytic reaction from proceeding fast enough to outstrip its source. And so he speculates that in this manner, maybe the first life was created, that you have a combination of autocatalytic reaction, some kind of a container, kind of like a cell wall or an early precursor of a cell wall or something like that, that contained it, which gives rise to the next level above the morphodynamic, which is the teleodynamic. The word teleo means end. And it was one of Aristotle's four causes. His final cause gave rise to the phrase teleological. And the difference between a teleological system and a morphological system is that that whirlpool maintained its form only because of the external constraint of the boulder. But the a living teleological system maintains its form by an automatic process where it creates a kind of a feedback loop. And this feedback loop involves a loop between the level of the whole organism and its parts that is self-referential. If you're familiar with Gödel's theory in mathematics, that any logical system cannot deal within the system with the statement that considers the entirety of the system to be a part within the system, and that creates sort of an openness to what would otherwise be a closed system. And so in this way, Deakin postulates that life created this open system that is what allowed biological evolution to emerge. And then biological evolution was a way, because of the genetic code and the storage of information about the environment in the genetic code, where the organism could, admittedly in kind of a retrograde manner, because it doesn't have the ability to look forward, which is why evolution has been called the blind watchmaker, that the evolutionary process doesn't look forward, but it does do a pretty good job of capturing information about the environment in the past in a way that's useful to help that organism constrain, this is one of Deakin's key words too, to constrain the way that genetic code expresses itself. The feedback from the environment in the form of the natural selection, the survival of certain traits, the non-survival of certain traits, is a way of constraining the information in the genetic code that gets passed on in a way that is referential to, is representative of the environment outside. So the organism now has a way of representing and referencing information outside of itself, really for the first time. And the final level he would then take it to would be the mental level, where you have the organism or the brain of the organism being able to conceive of hypothetical future states, and to use those hypothetical future states to guide its action. You know, what would happen if, you know, I were to step out this way? You know, that kind of is different from the information stored in the evolutionary sense, in that it is information about the future or postulates about the future. To use Deutsch's words, which he gets from Karl Popper, it is a conjecture about the future or an explanation about the future. And that conjecture or explanation about the future is also a constraint that helps shape the future actions that will be taken by that organism in a way that is now not random, and not purposeless, but is done now with the purpose of trying to fulfill this representation of some kind of future desired state. And so by kind of a chain involving these concepts of constraint, these concepts of part-whole, self-referential systems, and the concept of information being a correspondence between some sort of internal state and some referent or something represented outside, he kind of builds up this logic that he uses to explain really why, how purpose could develop in a in a naturalistic sense. And I think the contrast with somebody like Dennett is that Dennett is locked into protecting this concept of determinism, which seems to come from the classical mechanical system. Even though he talks about some of these other systems, he still feels like he needs to defend that. If he gives that up, he really is, you know, he's not getting rid of the bathwater. That he's still got this bathwater of some kind of supernatural interventionist system that he can't quite shake. So the two terms that that I think distinguish Dinkins' theory from Dennett's is that we already talked about determinism, but one term that Deacon defines is eliminated materialism, the assumption that all reference to intentional phenomena can and must be eliminated from our scientific theories and replaced by accounts of material mechanisms. So that's the idea that you, any talk about a purpose or a meaning or a function or a significance or something like that, must be replaced by some explanation of material in motion. And even the people who believe in eliminated materialism pretty much have to concede that there's some explanatory economy to using these phrases. And so they'll generally say, well, we use them for shorthand, but we know we're cheating. You know, we know we're really not given the right explanation. A couple examples of that. One Deutsch uses in his book is the explanation of why a particular copper molecule is in the nose of a statue of Winston Churchill in a square in London. You know, he says, you know, you could explain that in terms of concepts of valor and courage, World War II, all that. Or you could explain it in terms of the movement out of mines of the materials and all that. And obviously it's a lot more economical to explain it the first way than the second. The other example along those lines that Deacon uses is the example of a boy skipping stones in the water on the beach. It says, if you wanted to explain why one particular stone dislocated from the beach to 25 yards offshore, then you could try to explain that in terms of material in motion, but it's much easier to explain it in terms of the joy that the boy might find in watching the stone skip, and what he was learning about his own motor abilities and the properties of water, and then also the selection criteria that the boy went through to decide which rocks to pick up and skip. You know, he would pick ones that were maybe smooth and not ones that were round, and that selection process is an example of what Deacon would call, the constraint of the idea, because the constraint of the idea to pick only smooth stones is a filter which takes out sort of the random, kind of static noise possibilities of picking any object and throwing it, and the boy is now only picking out objects that he perceives would have the ability to skip across the water when he projects them. And that idea in the boy's mind of what stones will have that property is explanatory as to why that particular stone got from point A to point B, much more so than any kind of mechanical explanation of it. So that's an example of eliminated materialism. The other term I wanted to distinguish let's see. that. Well, I lost that particular place in my notes, but that's a kind of a pretty truncated version of what some pretty kind of multi-step theories, but hopefully gives you a taste and gives rise to some questions, I guess, in this area about how we might be able to reconcile our common sense notions of free will and agency with a naturalistic explanation to a naive realist, these questions wouldn't come up because the intuition of having free will is sort of so hardwired into us. But we can say, is that just evolutionary? Is that just because it has survival value, or does it really tell us something true about the universe, which is why it has to be examined more carefully? But I think there are some pretty decent arguments by Deacon and others that it does stand the test of being more than just kind of an evolutionary relic that we're wired into. People like Dennett call themselves compatibilist because they would say that the determinism, as they define it, is compatible with our notion of free will. And someone who would say they believe in determinism and it's not consistent with free will would be called a hard determinist. But it's pretty hard, I think, these days to find a hard determinist. We had a debate at Philosopher's Forum, and I think most of the ones that we found would call themselves compatibilist. I think the issues of kind of staking yourselves out as a hard determinist is that you do have to deal with this question of then what would be the basis for any kind of accountability or responsibility, you know, for actions. You know, why would we hold Osama bin Laden responsible, you know, for the death of people in the World Trade Center if there was only one possible future, and that possible future, you know, happened what happened, and so, you know, where's the culpability there? So it's not that many people want to go there. So I think really the issue these days is with the so-called compatibilist, but the view I've tried to present here is that I don't think that determinism is compatible with what we normally think of as free will and agency, and there are some naturalistic theories that involve no kind of supernatural parachuting in at all that do account for free will in a way that's not consistent with determinism. So sure, it's plainly obvious now, but the bathwater is the supernaturalistic explanations that all these thinkers are trying to avoid. The baby is our pretty intuitive notion that there is more than one possibility ahead of us, and you know, we have at least some control over what the future looks like. So thank you for your attention.
Okay, we'll open up some questions.
The fact that you started out with determinism, in other words, if an action is done, now you could run that with two different ways. In other words, you could say, okay, it's there's no way to know the future until you look back on it, for sure. Now, if you have the future, what happens? If you look at the future, and the only way to know for sure what happens is, so say if you're a supernaturalist, you look at the future and you say, well, it was determined by God or something. If you're a naturalist, you say, well, it was determined by mechanics or something. But I guess my question is, what happens on that, is that the way you see it? Or is that the way, you could go either way on that?
Well, I guess those two choices. There's that the future is supernaturally determined, by God, and then there's that the future is determined by mechanical causes only, explicable at the level of material causes. But I don't think that exhausts the field, because I think there's the possibility that I would defend that, the future isn't determined by either of those, that the future is at least partially determined by free action, of sentient beings making choices. And so there is this branching possibility. In Dennett's books, he kind of treats possibilities as only logical possibilities, and not, he'll admit that there are logical possibilities, Socrates could have red hair, is not illogical, but that in the real world, there's always only one. I think the other comment I'd have there is that a lot of these theorists would consider the idea of a Cartesian soul, meaning a soul that resides in this side of the Cartesian divide, the other side, the immaterial side of the divide, would be equally supernatural to God. So if the supernaturalism they're trying to defend against is not just God, but it's God and disembodied souls. I think they're trying to defend equally against both. The other point you raised that I've, thanks for the reminder on this, and the first part of your question is that there also is the view that there's only one possible future, but that it's impossible to know what it is. And so from an epistemological, a knowledge-based standard, there in fact are, we can't pin down what the future is. Even if we had the most powerful computer in the world, there would be limits to the amount of computations that the computer could do in a second. And so, it's against the limits of the universe to ever know what that future is. But some people would say that that's only a limit on knowledge. It's not an ontological possibility. It's only an epistemological limitation that we'll never know what the future will be.
Well, like you can only do one thing, and you don't know what it is until after you've done it, and then that's the one thing. And it could have just as well been something else, but you chose one thing.
Yeah, that's the other confusion I think Dennett makes is that he seems to take an after the fact look at it and say there's only going to be one future realized. And so there's only one actualized, and so that means there's only one. But it completely takes out what the possibilities or the potentialities. If you go back to Aristotle's system, he had the four causes. One of those causes, the final cause, had to do with potentialities. And potential is the word we get potent from, our power. In Aristotle's system, those potentialities had causal power, not just the actual, events in the universe. And so Deakin kind of picks up on that idea that the ideas that we hold as constraints on what would otherwise be random activity can have causal power, even though they're not in actual existence. And so it really comes to whether you think of potentialities as being ontologically real, or whether you think of only actualities, things that have been actualized, as being ontologically real. Aristotle's system doesn't work if you think only of actualities, because his whole final cause is potentialities becoming actualized. And, if only actual can cause that to happen, then there's no such thing as potentiality becoming actualized.
David, I think, is this on?
Yes.
Thing we left out, or you left out. thermodynamics, the laws of thermodynamics are kind of in a small system like Newton's physics were expanded by Einsteinian and quantum mechanics. Because even in the big universe, the whole universe, even though entropy may be increasing to a maximum, it may be in a cycle, and may, again, you know, Big Bang, etc. My point is that within that universe, there are processes that are increasing, thresholds of increasing complexity that seem to be against the flow of the second law of thermodynamics, to wit, evolution to more and more complex species, going from non-organic to life. And that's a threshold that's not reversible. And so you have this increasing in complexity, increase and a decrease in in entropy from the mass formless first bang, first part of the universe, to a now very organized, formed process universe that we have now. So within the increase of entropy, you still have small areas of increase entropy. The question is, within this, you still have, and I'm a compatibilist, that we do have constraints by physics, by genetics, by when and where we were born, et cetera, our sex, our mentality, the molecules and whatever that make up our brain. But still, within those constraints, we have choice, and we have, like you say, we choose which way to go home, or what to wear, or what to eat. So, what is your idea? Is it either or, both, what, free will and determinism?
Well, I simply don't believe in determinism as defined by Dennett, which is the notion that at any particular instant there is only one physically possible future, because I believe there's more than one physically possible future. So that would be my stance. And I'm sorry if I didn't bring out the point you raised clearly enough, but I would entirely agree that that there are systems that when we talk about the morphodynamic and the teleodynamic, those are the systems that are contrograde to entropy, but only within their system. I mean, the overall entropy still increases at its level, but at its level, there's definitely, that's why we're talking about sort of the direction of one system being orthograde, in the opposite direction, so they kind of, one of Deakin's terms is that the morphodynamic systems create what he calls a neg entropy ratchet, meaning that it takes the energy that would otherwise dissipate as entropy, and basically captures that energy to ratchet it back, literally in an order forming direction. So it's kind of like taking the energy and like judo almost, taking it and back on itself.
What David was saying indicates that there is a range of possibilities that we can choose from. Okay, so, what you're born with, the environment you're in, your capabilities, all that, it establishes a range, okay? But if there's only one thing that can happen, then what determines what that one thing is? That's question number one. And then the other question is that there are people, scientists among them, who say we have the ability to do time travel, or it's at least physically possible. Okay, well, if you go back in time and kill your grandfather, theoretically, you're still around. But the timeline you were in continues on somehow. So now you've got determinism for at least two different timelines. And if only one thing can happen, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that one. The time travel paradox, you know, I've read quite a few books that deal with it. I guess the answer to your first question, which is, if you take a deterministic position, you know, what determines that one thing that'll happen? I think they would have to say it's the initial conditions, you know, specified in effect in the Big Bang. You know, basically contained all the specifications for the future history of the universe, that you know only a very small change in those would make it vastly different. But that in the seed of those initial conditions, there's only one possible trajectory. I don't happen to believe that. I think okay. That's the way they would.
That's true.
Yeah, so
David,
we were chatting a bit before the meeting, and there's a lot of people that are talking and writing about this subject of free will right now. It's because the neuroscientists are really taking it up. And so I was just wondering if in Deacon's book he talks about how the brain has evolved to enable consciousness, and it's really in consciousness that we have these choices, and you know, we are able to have ethical choices and all kinds of choices because consciousness is something that humans have that maybe other animals don't have. But there's another neuroscientist that's recently written a book called Who's in Charge, a guy named Michael Gazzaniga. And so Gazzaniga, you know, is talking about how the physical structure of the brain is a layered system that somehow enables this consciousness process or system to operate, and he was a quantum physicist also from Berkeley. Has commented on Gazzaniga's book and his approach in the sense that he really sees it's the quantum level that's made it possible for you know consciousness to be able to have the ability to make a multitude of choices, and obviously, there was an example you gave earlier about throwing the rocks. We also our brains we're a learning system, so we're able to learn, and from that learning, make choices based on our learning as it relates to a multitude of decisions that we make every day. So I was just kind of wondering if Deacon gets into this whole consciousness area and how it's really the brain that it has enabled, we've evolved to have this consciousness, which is really where we have the ability, or it supports our ability to make all the choices that we make.
Yes, chapter 17 of Deacon's book has the heading consciousness, and he does treat on it. The chapter before that is called sentience, which he defines in a little different way than consciousness. I think his sentience definition would include, you know, kind of any kind of feeling response, you know, that would not necessarily involve a kind of a reflection on our own thinking, I guess, which would sort of be, yeah, would be more where he would, he does treat on it. I chose to leave it out as sort of my abbreviated narrative because it didn't seem as front and center to his theory some of these concepts of information and constraint and part-whole references and some of the other things that are in common, you know, it's sort of a slightly separate issue from the free will determinism as to whether, you know, kind of the mind-body problem, whether consciousness is, excuse me, mind-brain problem, whether consciousness is more than just the, you know, and I think his answer is that consciousness is more than just computation, because computation is not about anything. The same way that genetic information is not about anything, about a reference. And so his whole concept is that reference that really kind of gives rise to consciousness, and then when you make that a self-reference, you know, when your reference is now back to the own process of your thinking, then you have what we call consciousness. Do you get a follow-up?
Well, yeah, I've heard that argument. I've heard that argument before.
Changes from green to
yellow. Especially what Peter Strapp, the physicist, brings out after kind of in his commentary about Gazzaniga's writings is that, yeah, if you take away the brain, then you have no consciousness. Okay, so clearly this idea that somehow consciousness is some extended thing out there, I think Strapp makes a talks about that without this other, you know, physical body, this thing that kind of, maybe it at some level runs at the Newtonian level, but yet there's this quantum level that it enables. I mean, we don't really know yet. We know a lot about neurons and synapses and dendrites and glias and all that sort of stuff, but we still haven't cracked the base level at the quantum level, how that stuff, you know, works. And but I personally have a problem with people bring up this extension thing or somehow it's out there when all I've got to do is take away that brain and that particular consciousness is gone.
No, I'm not meaning to say it's out there. I mean to say that it's in the ability to have a representational or a referential reference to something out there. But it's
that's the way the brain works.
Yeah, but that's a key concept to him, because computer programs are not about anything unless somebody reads them to be about something. I mean, there's nothing inherent.
Well, I don't know if that metaphor works or not.
We have time for two more questions. Wynn, and then Paul.
Okay, I wanted to pose a suggestion to you and get some reaction from you on it. You started out with a good historical review, citing what I would see as paradigms following Kuhn, animism, for example, and then Aristotelianism, and then I think Laplace would be the key person to mention here, Laplacian determinism, and various forms of free will. It strikes me that these are all different paradigms. We have a real universe out there that we have to interact with. And most of us would agree with that. And in attempting to interact with them, we have to connect with some sort of mental paradigm. But there does seem to be some choice in this, depending on what our objective is. So, you know, is it a simple explanation, or are we trying to get, are we dealing with a simple system for which a certain amount of inertia and potential energy, etc., will help us to solve all this, or is it really a complex thing, like why is there a certain copper atom in the nose of some statue? So it strikes me that these are all different paradigms which might be used to try to explain this. Some of the paradigms are not acceptable for us nowadays, for one reason or another. But we still have a choice between this paradigm or that paradigm. What do you think of that?
I think that is remarkably similar to the argument that David Deutsch constructs in his book, The Beginnings of Infinity. He's more following on Popper than Kuhn. He's heavily influenced by Karl Popper. But I didn't dwell on him as much as I did Deacon because of just the time, and it was kind of hard to mix in both of them, but Deutsch's is that, I mean, just sort of read you a little bit from the blurb here. He says, uncompromisingly rational optimistic, Deutsch comes to startling new conclusions about the nature of human choice, scientific explanation, the evolution of our species of ideas. Actually, that isn't the part I wanted to do. Let's see. Well, I'm going to summarize it more than read. His idea is that we do make these conjectures or explanations about the universe, and that those explanations have what he calls reach, which is they may actually explain more than we're trying to explain. And so, you know, in the process of explaining what we're trying to explain, we may actually get this bonus. You know, if you want to think about NASA program and kind of the other technological, you know, efforts that that led to. And so Deutsch's notion is that actually by continuing to come up, that some explanations are good explanations, some explanations are bad explanations, that by the process of coming up with better explanations, you know, we can literally solve any problem we need to solve. He's an extreme optimist, you know, it's kind of unusual for a physicist, but my reaction would be what you're saying fits in very nicely with his thing.
Okay, that's changed again. Last question. I guess we need new batteries on that.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to need.
Paul, you have to go without it.
We can hear.
It's not doing.
Okay, great. Last question.
Okay. Well, one of the things I was going to ask was to get you to talk more about David Deutsch, so you've gotten into that. You said that you didn't believe in determinism, and seemed to be referring to a human agency. If conscious creatures had not arisen, would determinism be correct, and there would be only one possible future at the moment?
That's an interesting question. I guess my answer to that would be, if the evolution of the universe was only to the quantum mechanical level, no, because I don't think quantum dynamics is deterministic. If it evolved to the classical mechanical level, it's kind of hard for me to imagine, though, that you have classical mechanics without thermodynamics. And I don't think of thermodynamics in this deterministic in the same way I do classical mechanics. The reason is because thermodynamics is only a tendency, not an inevitable law. In other words, you can have these contrograde movements. It's just that they're not going to be likely, you know, over time. And so I don't think of that as deterministic. So I guess I would have to say I can only believe in determinism in a world in which all quantum mechanics had been smoothed out and decohered, and there was no thermodynamic, you know, which I have trouble with. So I guess that's hard for you to believe in determinism.
I think I can partially answer that. You know, it's possible that all of the air molecules in this room could go right to that corner and we would all suffocate. Possible, but not probable. You know, because of quantum mechanics, the probability are that they'll be random. So, whether there are humans in the world or not, the process of thermodynamics and quantum mechanics is that it's going to be random. Now, within that, you know, if it's possible for those atoms to become stars, to become more complex chemicals, to become more complex whatever, within that possibility, it's going to happen. So whether humans are in that formula or not, I don't think it matters.
Okay. Dave, concluding remarks.
Yeah, let me just, because I left out the second part of Jack's question, which is...
So you get two legs.
I already got one. The quantum part of your question, which is that there are quantum explanations for human free will, and that's actually the tack taken by Stuart Kaufman in his Reinventing the Sacred, as well as a book called The Physics of Consciousness that I can't remember the author of, but I've read it also, which have to do with these notions of quantum tunneling, or that when quantum probabilities collapse to classical mechanics, it has to do with a decoherence, is the term used, and some of the theories postulate that the brain is able to create a coherent quantum system long enough. You know, coherence would sort of be like a laser system of light where you have all these probability waves sort of, you know, kind of lined up together, and that the brain might be able to, you know, through quantum mechanisms, kind of overcome the deterministic mechanical universe. I don't find those personally as convincing as I do Deakin's model that has more of a kind of hierarchical emergent layer system, because to me the quantum level is so far down from the mental level and there's so many layers in between that a simple jump, you know, I mean, I guess there are quantum phenomena in the brain, but there's also thermodynamical phenomena in the brain, and I think these morphological and everything else. So that's my
let's give a round of applause.
Okay, we'll start the spring semester on Tuesday, January 8th. Thanks again.
No.